It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
All important. And I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. And in today's conversation, we're going to be talking about conservation education, or shorthand for that is CE, and how it helps people of all ages understand and appreciate our country's natural resources. We're also going to learn how to conserve those resources for future generations. Krista?
And I'm Dr. Krista Longton, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at IUPUI and Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. With us today, we have Dr. David Frixel, Executive Director and Ecologist, the Dennis Conservation Land Trust. Welcome, Dave. So happy to have you today.
Thank you both for having me.
This is exciting, Dave. So let's talk first so everybody gets an idea. What is the idea of a conservation land trust?
The idea of a conservation land trust is to protect property in perpetuity for future generations. So here at the Dennis Conservation Land Trust, we're situated on Cape Cod, which is a place that's very popular and has experienced extreme developmental pressures since about the 60s and 70s. And so our mission is to conserve kind of the most environmentally sensitive lands for future generations. And there are a whole host of benefits for the public and for nature itself. And that's why we do it.
Can I jump in with a quick question already, Mark?
Yeah.
Awesome. So Dave, one of the things you said there just made me think a little bit about a term that maybe our listeners might not be familiar with. They might get it based on the context clues, but that phrase was developmental pressure. So could you talk a little bit before we kind of dig into some of this education piece about, besides just building stuff, what is developmental pressure and how does that shape your work?
So developmental pressure is kind of a planning issue, like a town planning issue, right? If there were no rules or regulations surrounding how we developed structures on properties, you might imagine it would not be done in the smartest way. In recent history, there's been popular news articles about urban or suburban sprawl and how sprawl is an ideal for humanity's living in harmony, so to speak, with nature. And that's exactly what I was getting at is development pressure is really just a lot of people wanting to move to a place or own property and build homes in a place. And I think Cape Cod is kind of the epicenter of that issue. Most of the homes here are actually vacant year round because many people in the greater Boston area and the Hartford, Connecticut, Providence, Rhode Island areas have summer homes here. And so they will buy up beach cottages and other properties and leave them vacant. And they're not really a year round part of the community. So those folks, we all here have to think more intelligently about where we develop, how we develop, and which properties we want to conserve for future generations. Yeah.
That, you know, is also the pressures that you're talking about. They're everywhere. In Central Indiana, Central Indiana Land Trust does a similar kind of thing. Their developmental pressures are a little different than the Cape, which are pressures for, you know, retail and that kind of thing. And so it's, you know, there's this mass move to put strip kinds of malls and retail, you know, with restaurants and that into locations. And so it's the same idea. What you're trying to do is hold on to that land. When you say forever, do you really, how does that happen? How can you actually protect something forever?
Well, forever is a tough concept to wrap your head around. I must admit it is for me as well. Really, forever? Are we sure that we want to protect this particular property for conservation forever? Especially given all the changes that are happening to our environment and to our society and that we expect to happen over the next century alone. So we say forever because legally the properties we own are protected forever. One tool that we commonly use is called a conservation restriction in Massachusetts. Elsewhere, it's called a conservation easement. And that is sort of an encumbrance, a legal restriction on a property that carries with the deed. So even if our organization were to, or a conservation organization were to part ways with a property that had a restriction, that restriction follows the deed or the title for that property forever. So legally, it is forever. Now, if down the road in the future, if there were any legal challenges to the concept of a conservation easement, you know, you could imagine there are situations where it isn't quite forever, but legally it's forever.
And do you acquire most of, Dave, you require acquire most of the land from individuals, either by purchase, I know that's something you do, but also by gifting? They gift sometimes because they don't want that land to go through what you were saying, that excess development?
Yes, exactly. So we have acquired properties by many different means. Early on in our organization's early days, it was mostly by gift because we weren't very well funded. But now we've gotten more strategic about the properties we want to protect, in part because we've gotten better at seeking funding to purchase higher value properties, but also because here, there is a housing crisis on Cape Cod, as I know there is in so many other places. And we don't want to prevent housing in areas of relatively low conservation value by protecting those properties. So what we try to do is find the properties with the highest conservation values and then pursue and fundraise to purchase those. So we've had properties gifted by individuals who want to see their property conserved, and we also target and fundraise for the acquisition of specific high value, high conservation value properties.
That was my next question. You sort of clarified that there. So obviously, as we think about land, we think about this concept of conserving a certain part of property forever, that there are, you know, I live in a house that was built in the early 1900s. You know, I think there's a park nearby my house that I know the city of Indianapolis, for example, has wanted to protect for many years and has been at risk. So can you talk a little bit about what are the kinds of things that you look for when you talk about high conservation value? Like, what makes you want to protect, you know, one plot of land more so than another?
Right. Well, here on Cape Cod in particular, one of the biggest challenges that our communities will face are results from sea level rise. And that's kind of the big topic here. And what we really want to do is allow for sea level rise without any conflict with individuals, the homeowners, structures, and so on. So at the Dennis Conservation Land Trust, we've been targeting those type of properties that have some uplands, which is land higher in elevation than the water table, as well as wetlands and in particular salt marsh, which is very abundant and has all sorts of benefits for society and like our global society even. Salt marsh, you know, sequesters more carbon than even mature forests do. So there are things like that, but to put the prioritization of all these different properties on Cape Cod in practice, what we tend to do is use some conservation values that are published by the state of Massachusetts, and so those are relatively easy data to get your hands on, and some of those resources were also developed by the Nature Conservancy. It's basically maximizing biodiversity conservation, habitat connectivity. So we're more likely to want to pursue a property that's next to a large conserved property to begin with. And then there are a whole host of other ones as well.
the competition, Dave, then must be really interesting because you're going after a high value property. There are developers going after it. But I think there's nuances to it. Does a seller sometimes wish to be able to get it to you rather than to have it developed?
Yes, that's certainly the case. Sometimes I do fear that most often we aren't even approached because landowners assume we won't be able to pay the same purchase price as a private developer would, but that's actually not the case. And that's largely due to incentives provided by the state and the federal governments. They have grant programs that, and they provide tax incentives as well to property owners to sell to us versus a private developer. And that in particular is for properties that the state and the federal government believe have high conservation values. So some of the things I was talking about before. But right now we have an acquisition project, and the homeowners, they trace their roots back centuries in this area, and they've essentially become priced out, and they seem to be set on selling to conservation and to our organization in particular, because they know we'll keep the property as it is, and they'll be able to come back and visit and see what they poured their heart and soul into for generations intact as it has been. So.
It must be powerful to build those relationships with folks around, this piece of land. I mean, if you think about this family that you're working with, and to be trusted with something that they care about very deeply. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, something you said was that homeowners don't even know that it would be competitive to sell land to you as they're thinking about kind of their estate planning, those kinds of things. Can you talk a little bit about some of those wish you knew kind of things? Like, what do you wish folks knew or understood about the way that land trust works that you spend some time educating folks about?
Well, I think I kind of hit on a couple of them so far, but one, of course, is that we do fundraise to purchase properties, and that the government is often available to assist, and they provide incentives both for us as the land trust, but also to the seller. There's a massive reduction in capital gains taxes, for example, for a charitable sale to a nonprofit conservation organization. So I'd say that's the main one. Yeah.
When you think about this, and it's interesting. I want to go back to a point that you made, which I think everybody everywhere in the United States, across the Midwest, we're all really concerned, even if we're not on the Cape, with sea level rise and sequestering of CO2. I mean, it's with all of that. And I think that it might be helpful to have you tell our listeners a little bit about what is the science behind why those wetlands can sequester so much.
So most basically, the decomposition. So decomposition is a term that refers to kind of the breakdown of organic matter. And when an environment is wet, and particularly when it's wet land, there's very little oxygen in the soil. And oxygen is required often by the decomposing little microorganisms, the critters that break that stuff down. So in wet environments, carbon that is taken in by plants in wet environments and ends up in the soils tends to stay there and not decompose. So wet environments are definitely the best sequesters of carbon, and protecting those environments will help us sequester as much carbon as we can. And in particular here on the Cape, it's we have a lot of salt marshes, which are known, salt marshes and mangroves are kind of two of the ecosystems that are known to sequester kind of the most carbon per unit area, even more than, upland forests and so on. We're big on protecting those habitats, but also protecting upland habitats right next to the wetlands so that as sea levels rise, the salt marsh can continue to grow and thrive kind of inland, as that happens.
So it's holding on to that carbon through its decomposition. In other words, it's laying down matter. Sometimes, yep. I know I've walked with you, but I've also walked in Indiana, and there's peat that gets laid down, right, in those marsh. And that is really, that is sequestered carbon, right?
Exactly.
It can become very thick.
It can become really thick. And this, I think, was common across the United States, but I know for a fact here on Cape Cod that, you know, peat was often used as a fire starter in the colonial era. So folks would go out and actually remove those centuries worth of compiled peat and actually remove it from the environment for use. And so that, of course, when that peat is burned, it then releases carbon back into the atmosphere. And if those areas aren't restored to the wetland that they once were, that area is no longer sequestering carbon. And we've released all that had been sequestered there. So this is something that the federal government and many state governments had become very concerned about in the environment, at the dawn of the environmental movement with the passing of the Wetlands Protection Act. So humans at one point saw little value in wetlands, but as scientific understanding increased and all of these services that are provided by wetlands like carbon sequestration had come to be recognized, the government decided to protect those environments.
And I know there was an experiment in for obvious reasons with what you're talking about didn't work, but there was an experiment and you could trade, you know, if you're a developer and you want a wetland, as long as you put one in somewhere else, you can trade. For obvious reasons, that was a big failure. Can you talk a little bit about why taking out a wetland would be a big failure? You can't just put another one in.
Right. Well, I mean, nature is so complex. So I'm in a empirical scientist. I enjoy studying nature as it is, not an engineer, and all the power to the engineers trying to construct wetlands, but they simply don't function the same as a natural wetland. But I will, Mark, just mention that those sort of mitigation measures are still widely used, not only in wetlands protection rules here in the state of Massachusetts and beyond, but you know, also with carbon sequestration, right? The carbon credit market right now, you know, by and large, many people think it's a good thing, but there's been some contention about its role and whether it's actually driving people to, you know, make better decisions that will help with the carbon problem.
It's sort of a very human thing, right? I mean, to think that we can sort of buy our way out of a centuries old problem that we've created. And I think that that's one of the things that, as I think about your work, Dave, and I think about your kind of commitment to education, to helping folks feel like they have the information that they need to be able to support organizations like yours. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between, you know, you build relationships with your community members, you were talking about sort of those developmental pressures. How do you, how do you talk to folks? How do you get to meet folks on the ground? Where do you find them to kind of say like, hey, let me tell you a little bit about why just simply buying that offset isn't gonna solve the problem that you think it's gonna solve?
Well, we're a nonprofit, right? So we make every effort to reach out to every corner of our community and get support, whether it be financial support, but also just to educate people. And that, you know, that's becoming a central focus of our organization, in particular as there's less and less land to conserve available in our little town. Now I'm forgetting your question. I apologize, Krista.
That's okay. It was essentially like, how do you find the right people to care about this thing? I mean, when I think about, you know, when I think about this kind of, like I said, when you think about sort of the offset market, right, which is something that's very trendy, I think, and help folks understand that this is one small way, but that there are these sort of longer term approaches that we can take to thinking about conservation that isn't just sort of buying our way out of the problem.
Right. Well, I don't think that there are particular people that we try to approach per se. We're trying to tell everybody, and we're doing a lot of work in the schools and getting the students outside and experiencing nature firsthand, which for me, I know is critical in the development of my love for nature. And I do think that's an innate thing, but it has to be cultivated. And so you got to get people outside, and that's the easiest way to convince them that nature is worth saving and that constructed environments, like constructed wetlands, aren't quite the same.
That's a really great segue. We've been talking with our guest, Dr. David Fritzell. And when we come back, we're going to add Ian Ives from the Mass Audubon to our conversation and further explore the ideas behind conservation education and why education is so important. We'll be right back.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Christelle Longton, and today we're having a conversation with our guests, Dr. David Fritzell and Ian Ives, about the ways structured education experiences and activities targeted to varying age groups and populations can enable people to realize how natural resources and ecosystems affect each other and how resources can be used wisely. So Ian, thanks for being with us today. I would love to hear a little bit more about your role, your organization's role in ensuring that the folks on the ground who maybe don't work in the environmental sector learn about the important work that you're doing and how they can kind of be a part of it.
Right, well, thanks for having me. Well, Mass Audubon is New England's largest environmental nonprofit organization, and Mass Audubon is the first Audubon across the country. And we originally formed to address the millinery trade by two Boston Brahmins who decided they were going to do something about mass killings of birds. But over time, the organization has expanded to become much more directly involved in advocacy and education. I think that stemmed purely from the obvious need to disseminate information about conservation to the general public. And so today, Mass Audubon does a lot of work. In fact, probably the biggest chunk of our annual operating budget goes towards our education staff and our programming to reach out to not just, you know, Massachusetts residents, of course, but people across the country to help, you know, connect people to nature. And that's really what we're all about. And, you know, you really, you can do all the science you want to do, but if you're not disseminating it and describing and articulating the complexities behind it, David was saying that you're really not going to get very far. So Mass Audubon does a lot of work in this area.
And you, when you, both of you, when you're thinking about it, you're doing it from not necessarily doing a negative kind of approach to what it is, but you're trying to say how these are assets, right? Mm-hmm. You're trying to use an approach to education that makes these things special for people rather than.
That's a great point. Yeah, I can't think of, as there's so many opportunities to disseminate information to people that just is complex. So a good example, recently Mass Audubon has embarked upon a very large and very novel salt marsh restoration project. And the techniques that we're employing are really new, in some cases experiential and pioneering. And for a lot of folks, the things that we're proposing to do in restoration is a little scary. Sometimes it involves taking large equipment out onto preserved areas, using techniques that people aren't necessarily comfortable with. And so it's really important to have the community, the stakeholders understand these new techniques and proposed practices. And it's a positive. What we're trying to articulate is that these techniques, while they may seem novel and sometimes heavy-handed, they're based on a lot of experience and knowledge, accumulated knowledge over the years, best practices in ecological management and restoration. And it could be something as small as restoring or creating a small vernal pool to enhance biodiversity, or it could be something as large as restoring a 1,000-acre salt marsh to help build resiliency against sea level rise from climate change. So everything in between. And scale is really important in some of these projects to explain what we're doing.
One of the things I'm struck by is the, you were talking about the scale and the extent to which folks sometimes can see that that scale as scary. You know, Mark knows, and some of our listeners know that I love to talk about the relationship between human emotion and our scientific decision making, right? That it's hard sometimes for us to envision the long game. You know, we think about, you know, our grandchildren's future, but we need to think sort of three or four generations down. Whether we're talking about, you know, a land trust or the great education work that Mass Audubon has done. So Dave, I'm wondering if we can maybe start with you and then Ian jump over, but how do you, when you're talking with folks about selling a property that's been in a family for six generations, or you're talking about bringing a huge piece of equipment to the place where you've always brought your kids to play and experience nature, what kinds of conversations do you have with folks in terms of helping them to understand the scope and scale of your work as sort of beyond the existing generation?
Well, I would say it's definitely, in particular, talking about the future and far into the future, that will always remain a challenge. But I think especially for the folks who have been on a property and used a property for so many generations, it's a little bit less challenging to imagine that many generations into the future. So we have quite a bit of that on Cape Cod. And so perhaps it's slightly easier to connect with some of those, with those folks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially here on Cape Cod, people have a very, very strong sense of place and are very preservation minded. You know, especially in the areas that David and I work. And so, you know, change can be difficult, and especially if these are practices or techniques that aren't familiar, it can come as a bit of a surprise.
I think what's really interesting in what you're both saying with that is I never, in my own mind, and I imagine our listeners didn't really think of conservation as being restoration. You know, or including that. In other words, I thought you acquired a property, you conserved it, right?
Right.
But restoration is a whole different animal. And I can see why that would be confusing to people, because you're invading the property that you, in a way, right?
Yeah, this traditional thought with land protection is to protect it and leave it, I think, in a lot of cases. But these days, we've learned many techniques that have been tested over time that we now feel more confident with applying. And also I think there's a sense that, we're not playing God, so to speak. We hear that term thrown around sometimes. Well, you're playing God out there. You're making decisions about what area to protect, what area not to protect, what species to choose and what species not to choose. But here on the Cape and most places in this country, we've played God long ago. We've done a lot of disturbance in many different ways. And so what might seem to someone to be a virgin protected wildlife sanctuary really isn't at all. It's been degraded and disturbed in all sorts of different ways. And now we have the opportunity to take these practices and make these hands-on changes. It's almost like ecological engineering. And there may be some trade-offs. You may lose a few things, but on balance, you're going to have so much more gain. And so that's another, I sort of am saying that crudely, but that's another whole element to bring to this is that consideration,
And it's also, restoration is also a challenge, right? Because there's often a significant time lag from when you begin the project to when it looks like nature again. And maybe this isn't the case with the salt marsh, marsh restoration, but a lot of the work we do is just removing terrestrial plant species. One of the problematic ones, our group of species here are invasive vines that kind of crawl up trees, and then the trees get blown over and it destroys the forests. And in our work of clearing out all these vines, sometimes the property will look completely bare. And it's a great example to take people from the public out onto those properties to explain to them that it doesn't look great right now, but we're playing the long game in conservation and restoration. It'll get better from here.
A great point. And I think you're right to say that Dave, the picture that you paint for us there is really helpful, right? Sort of painting that picture for listeners or for, you know, the folks as you're proposing a project like this, right? To say, you know, in the short term, here's what this might look like. But in the long term, you know, we're talking about bringing bird species back in that might not have been able to find what they needed to eat and so on. You know, so I think that for me as a scholar of science communication, as a scholar of health communication, it makes me think about my undergraduate rhetoric courses, right? What kinds of language do we use that are most persuasive? Because I can't show you a picture into the future, right? And that future might be beyond my lifetime. So I think that that's really powerful. I'm wondering, you know, as we think about these kinds of education programs, Dave, you talked about the importance of bringing folks into the spaces, and I'm sure, Ian, this is important for your work as well. Can you paint a picture of what one of these education programs might look like? So is it just like going on a nature hike? What else could folks expect from engaging in an education program around these issues? And Ian, if you want to start.
Oh, okay, sure. Well, I can think of an example whereby for a wetland restoration project we were doing on Cape Cod, we opened up the project as a workshop. And in this case, we were inviting professionals, so they might have been engineers or ecological consultants, but it could also be regulators and folks in the agencies interested in learning novel techniques. And the workshop was hands-on, so they were participating in the project. They were learning about the permitting in the early stages of design all the way through the implementation. And so they got to see for themselves and actually take part in getting their hands dirty in the field, these techniques. And that was more of a technical workshop, but we also do a variety of more general audience programs that connect people to projects that we're doing. Again, the Salt Marsh project, that it's still in its early phases, but we're hoping to bring in lots of stakeholders in the community as part of a workshop where we'll take them out to the salt marsh and they can see, they start to learn how to read the landscape, understand what the impacts are, because many of these impacts are invisible. You can't see them at all. They're built-in infrastructure underneath the marsh that's grown in over time. They can really start to learn from the experts. And that's very powerful when you can get out into the field in a hands-on way and take part in the process.
I would certainly echo what Ian said, and I would add to the invisible things, also the microscopic things. I am a pond nerd, and I love to encourage everybody to go muck around in the pond, go out to the middle of that swamp that seems impassable, and take a close, careful look at what you're seeing. Grab a water sample, take it back to a microscope, and just look at all the amazing geometric shapes and learn a little bit about those critters. And I think, it's all about getting people out, having an adventure that's a bit exciting. And for us here, I feel like most of the people I interact with from the public are unaware of the amazing biodiversity that's present here, but also in everybody's backyard all across this country. There's so many nature documentaries these days that show the classic coral reef ecosystems or the large mammals in Africa, but my mission, at least, is to convince people that we have all that amazing biodiversity right here. You just might need to look, might need to squint a little bit harder, have a microscope or a pair of binoculars. But it's really, I think, getting people to see the critters is often one of the most successful.
I think that's, Dave, that's a critical point. And it dovetails well with what Ian was talking about. And that is, it's trying to see things that you might not anticipate seeing. And I remember from my work in museums and doing research that a lot of what we learned was that really people are drawn to really big. So that makes sense, like elephants and dinosaurs and all that. But they're equally drawn to something really tiny. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times as educators in environment, we've left out the really tiny. Mm-hmm. And that's the exciting thing, because isn't it true that most of what we haven't named yet, don't even know exists, is in that micro world, and either in insects as a macro or in something that is microscopic only. Mm-hmm. And they can be amazing looking. They can look like it like a giant dinosaur when you zoom in on them.
I couldn't agree more. You want to get loud because in my mind, you know, as David was saying, I don't think you can really act on behalf of nature until you learn to love it first. So if you can inspire, that'll bring action.
Wow. So I love, again, I love this idea. What other kinds of techniques do you all use in terms of education to really get people to notice?
So what are some other things that ties into education is volunteer opportunities. Huh? We have a lot of folks that are interested either out of college or to engage in lifelong learning and everything in between, where there's opportunities to take part in some of the work we're doing on a volunteer basis. It gets their foot into the door, into the organization, and also sometimes, you know, leads to a much deeper dive into their interests and sometimes into employment as well. So, you know, a lot of our volunteer opportunities across the state are actually education, you know, and professional development. And Mass Audubon has the largest number of volunteers of any nonprofit organization, environmental or otherwise, in the state of Massachusetts. So we really put a lot of time and resources into, you know, utilizing volunteers to run the organization, everything from visitor services to education to property management, advocacy work, and the like.
One of the things that Mass Audubon has pioneered, or another thing that they pioneered at least locally in Massachusetts, is the concept of all persons trails. They go beyond ADA accessibility, but you know, they're just trying to get as many people outdoors and to experience nature as possible. And so they use all sorts of creative techniques. I'm sure, Ian, you might know more about it than I do, but anything to encourage folks to get outside, given a breadth of different interests and abilities.
Yeah, that's huge. It's really huge. And the organization is trying to not only make the trails all access, but the process of creating the trails accessible and all access. So we're reaching out to stakeholders. Barnstable has a disability commission. So we started just by reaching out to them, have them come out and tour the site and get a better understanding of what their needs are, because we don't want to pretend to know everything, of course, that someone with a disability needs. And we're constantly adapting the guidebook that we've developed for all persons trails with that feedback. And also an area that's really exciting, I really would love to get Mark and David's input on, is some of the overlays for all persons trails. So going beyond the trail surface, the infrastructure, but creating the educational component, that's so exciting. And there's so much opportunity for creativity and site-specific learning there. I'm really looking forward to.
Right. And I might just add, Mark, a couple more things that we do. They're fairly minor and widely used, but they actually are successful in getting a lot of people who might not otherwise be interested in using our trails out into nature. And those are there's something called a story walk, which is essentially a storybook. You post a children's book or even an adult book just along a trail out in nature, and it gets people interested in the topic of that book that might not otherwise be interested in going on a trail. And then the other one is very popular across the nation is geocaching. So we place geocaches out on our properties and hide them in interesting areas that, you know, even trail users might not normally find, you know, like off trail, even a little bit to a unique and interesting area on a property. And those get logs all the time. And those folks are often adventure explorers. They might not take the time to really stop and look at their surroundings when they're in nature, but I think geocaching helps them do that.
Right, those are great. Also, because they're more of a general interest, you might draw in folks that wouldn't otherwise think of going to a wildlife sanctuary, just right, because of the sheer excitement of the challenge of finding that item. A great idea.
I was going to say, Mark, one of the things that brings me to think about is the use of technology and how technology is an important part of engaging our communities. Again, for folks who might not have access to your physical spaces, but might be interested in the work that you're doing, or maybe have access to technology in some way, but maybe not the resources to be able to sort of engage in some of those experiences. Would either of you be willing to talk a little bit about how technology has changed your work in the past few years, whether that's about connecting with the community or even the kind of restoration or work that you do with your constituents?
I might start and just mention a few things. I haven't been in this line of work for very long, but we make use of technology, of course, and in particular, the use of wildlife cameras and drones and automated photo and video platforms are amazing for attracting users on platforms like Instagram and Facebook and TikTok. And it really does reach a different audience than we otherwise would be able to. And it gets people who aren't able to get out into nature. It gets them to see what is out there in their backyards. And it gets even us as the deployers of wildlife cameras to see things we otherwise would never be able to see. So that's one.
One of the silver linings of the pandemic, of course, has been the advent of Zoom and just the accessibility to online programming. So we've done a lot of online programming, as David has, I'm sure, to great success, and just increase the number of participants in any given program because you can sit at your dinner table and watch and eat. You know, I mean, it really has. I was, when COVID broke and we pivoted to this massive online approach, I was frustrated because so much of my work and our work as an organization is to disconnect people from the screens, right? But we soon realized that, you know, resistance is futile, especially for the younger generation. We're going to need to pivot ourselves to help make our programming more accessible. So it's almost like it's an entry point. You get people connected through this medium and then hope that you can take them beyond and get them outdoors where we really want them to be.
So that really, what you're talking about really is this idea that it's an extension of accessibility. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Right. I mean, accessibility can come in a variety of forms. We always think about maybe we just need to get somebody on the trail, but sometimes we can't. Mm-hmm. You know, I think of some in every city, Indianapolis has it. We have it. A lot of elderly, a lot of seniors, some are mobile, but some can't, even if we make the trail accessible. But this opens. A couple things occur to me. One is the repurposing of what hunters used. And it's amazing in Indianapolis, there's a huge project, but I know nationwide, and I know Dave, I think you've used them, Ian, maybe, mm-hmm. but used hunting cameras that are day night, and you strap them to a tree and they can tell you what's going back and forth there, which we might never have seen.
Yeah, the infrared cameras are amazing. Most of the, you know, the wildlife that we have around here is either crepuscular happening during the early morning and evening hours, or they're nocturnal, and you won't be able to capture your movement unless you have that technology.
One other piece of technology that is super interesting for those folks who use it, and Ian, maybe Mass Audubon does some of this, GPS radio collars on wildlife. You get to publish maps of where individual named animals have moved. And I was in graduate school in Santa Cruz, California, and there is a big mountain lion population. And of course, people are scared of mountain lions, but the research group who was studying them started using these GPS collars and then decided to publish the story of all these named individual mountain lions. And I think that kind of turned many people's perspectives on what these mountain lions are and made them open up to learning about why they're important for conservation more broadly.
We've used some of that technology for ospreys, tracking ospreys, and learning more about their movements as a migratory species. And, you know, researchers now, through the technology, they can sit at their computers, they can follow Google Earth and literally follow an osprey on its 6,000-mile journey from Cape Cod down to the Amazon. And you can see the speed they're flying, you can see the elevation, where they're spending their time. And you can gather so much information in such a short period of time that would have taken a researcher maybe a lifetime to gather.
Yeah, and I think what's amazing is the how they've made things so small. The technology is tinier and tinier with antennas, and you can even get them on something like a butterfly. I mean, they can actually track, you know, migration patterns of things, which to me is just an unbelievable experience. Besides just having observers visually, but you're also getting much more data on from electronic tracking as well.
And it's a great teaching tool too, because it shows people how connected our global environment are. And I think there is, Osprey in particular, you know, they make this massive migration. So not only how we treat them here is important, but how they're treated, the Osprey, along their migration route every year, year after year. And the same is true for so many different animals, not only the flying ones. And I think it's a great educational tool to teach that principle. Mm-hmm.
Well, just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others any of the ideas we're exploring today in our show, and we'll be right back.
This is Dave Bagdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation with our guests, Dr. David Frixel and Ian Ives, about conservation education and how it provides a framework for people to develop the critical thinking skills they need to understand the complexities of ecological problems. And I think for me, that's one of the things that I sort of heard in the tenor of our last conversations, the idea that ecological problems are complicated. And it sounded to me like we were talking about geocaching, we were talking about GPS on animals, that it to me speaks to this notion that humans like to hear a story, right? That story is something that can often draw you in to better understanding a problem. So I would love to hear from either of you a story that you tell really regularly when you're thinking about engaging the community and how that's been effective for you in bringing folks into your work.
Go ahead, David.
Sure. So one story that is pervasive here on Cape Cod is just how land use change has affected what we see out in nature these days. And so when I take people out onto our properties, we own a lot of former cranberry bog. Cape Cod was kind of the mecca of the cranberry industry for a long time, and it since has become more profitable to grow cranberries elsewhere. But I love telling people about how the practice of cranberry bogging compacted the soil so much that now the communities that live in these bogs, plant communities, so the different types of plant species that live in the bogs is completely different. And the soil is completely different than it had been before. And then there are all sorts of knock-on consequences. But that's one that's pervasive here in this local environment and is fairly complicated, and a lot is known about it. But I think because it ties in history, our shared human history here with nature, it's a broader interest than if it was just an ecological story.
We have a lot of misconceptions, misunderstandings about living with wildlife. We get calls all the time. Sometimes we'll refer them to rehabilitation centers or to other experts, but some of the misconceptions have to do with some of the predators, carnivores, coyotes, for example, and how best to navigate your daily life, taking your dogs out and so on. One of the stories we talk about is, the colonization of these animals over time and how, you know, in most cases, these animals really, they've learned to adapt to live with you, and they're taking advantage of us. In a lot of respects, like, you know, the coyotes are learning how to navigate through neighborhoods and, you know, eating out of our gardens now. They're not just living in the woods hunting rabbits, and the stories about how these animals have evolved and adapted to living in the suburban environment. It's really, really interesting to people, because especially on the Cape, people are so connected to their natural environment. They see things they don't understand, and there's sometimes their knee-jerk reaction is fear. And we can tell them stories about how these animals really are out to adapt and evolve, but they're not necessarily looking to harm.
It's really helpful to hear. Yeah, I mean, it's right that one of the ways that you can sort of combat those messages of fear is to sort of say, like, let's think about, you know, almost empathize, if you will, with the experience of, you know, a coyote who's just looking for its next meal in the way that it always has, but all of a sudden the neighborhood looks very different.
So I think a bit of what you both are doing is people have been removed, a lot of people, especially urban people, for a very long time now from actual encounters with wildlife. And you're describing that when the wildlife comes to you, right? I mean, into your area, now you get scared. But I think that fear extends over into just going outside, just going down a trail. Mm-hmm. So how do you help attract people to doing that who might be really afraid to even join in with your program or to come? What are some of the ways you attract them?
Go ahead, David.
Well, now I'm thinking of Mass Audubon's All Persons Trail Manual.
Right.
They just publish every detail they can think of about a trail ahead of time, so that anybody who has concerns can look up information and quell their concerns. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think just that experience of going to a place that you feel comfortable with to start incrementally, you know, taking deeper steps and doing so with someone who has knowledge and information to share and comforting, you know, again, to the idea of the all persons trail, we can provide access to nature in ways that's not scary, that's a transition. You know? And there's nothing better than just experiencing these things to overcome anxieties and fears, telling the stories, as you just mentioned before, you know, the stories about how animals that you're living with live their lives and the realities and dispelling rumors. It goes a long way when someone can say that with authority and make you feel better.
And I think one of the things you do and one of the skills is that you have a lot of entry points. So the trail may not be the only destination or entry point. Mm-hmm. I know that you think about classes, or you think about walks and talks, or you think about using the arts in different ways as a part of what you do. I know, Ian, and I know you've got a wonderful, beautiful center that allows for activities to occur inside. And that it may not be, a part of it may be going on a trail, but it may not be the central reason that somebody comes. They may want to engage in learning to paint. And then all of a sudden you sneaky environmentalists move us over into going outside. But I think that's part of it, isn't it?
Yeah. And starting in a place that feels safe might be going to them. It might be, you know, we've been partnering with a local brewery and doing a wildlife lecture series. People may feel more comfortable to go to a neighborhood restaurant and learn about something that's foreign to them, like the environment. So that could be a starting point. And then from that point, maybe graduate to a visit to the Discovery Center for an indoor program. And then maybe the next step is taking a walk on some of the trails around the sanctuary and gradually increase the level of change and uniqueness.
As you all think about your future programming, the future kind of conservation education that you seek to do, you know, as populations change, delivery mechanisms change, what's a couple of things maybe, or one thing that you're really excited about, but also something that you're a little concerned about, or an opportunity that you think you might need to have to think harder about? So something that you're excited about as you think about future programming, but also maybe something that gives you pause or that you still haven't figured out how to solve it yet. I don't know, Dave, if you've got an idea on either side of that coin.
Well, one of the challenges that we're that I've been facing in the town of Dennis is there's a large segment of the population that we haven't been successful in connecting with, and many of those folks are recent immigrants from Brazil who have almost no language training in English. And so one of the goals of mine is to connect with the Brazilian Portuguese speaking community here and get them outside and into nature. So that's a major challenge. And luckily as that demographic grows, there are more and more, you know, trained conservationists who speak both Portuguese and English around. And so I'm really excited about connecting with them and trying to draw in that segment of the community.
Thanks for sharing that, Dave. That's one of the things I think, as I think about my experience in Central Indiana as well. We too have, this show is in English, obviously, we too have seen a lot of growth in our refugee populations across Marion County. And as we think about creating science programming, arts-based programming, health programming, part of what we're thinking about is how do we meet folks where they are? How are we adapting to, you know, Dave, we were talking earlier about physical changes in the built environment and how that, you know, how that sort of shapes the way we think about conservation. We know that a lot of the folks that are moving to Indianapolis, which is an incredibly car dependent city, are traditionally more, more walking based, and our city's just not set up to be a very walk friendly city. So thinking about how are we, you know, creating not only built environments, but also programming and connections for folks where their native language is not English. So I appreciate you sharing that. I think that's something that lots of folks are dealing with. Ian, what about you guys? What are you excited about, or what gives you pause as you're thinking about doing education programming?
Well, it's, for me, it's the advancement of the inclusive and equitable access piece. And we know that we're going to have to expand the community interested in our work if we ever want to be successful ultimately. And so going to some of these environmental justice communities, which we have quite a few of here in the Cape and certain towns that you wouldn't expect, you know, including Dennis and so on. And just trying to bring in the next generation of conservation, starting with the youngest ages. So that could even start at a preschool level, and trying to engage the youngest members of our community in what we call, nature preschools, where they're spending most of their time outdoors instead of inside, and during that most impressionable developmental phase. And that, I think, is the best way to increase the accessibility and equity. Inclusiveness is start at the youngest age because they're going to be graduating through, over time.
We want to thank both of you. Dave Furtzel from the Dennis Conservation Land Trust and Ian Ives from the Long Pasture Wildlife Sanctuary. And this has been a really enlightening conversation and really helpful, I think, to have to explain all of that. Thank you both for being a part of this.
I'm so glad to be part of it.
Yeah, thank you for having us. Looking forward to more conversations in the future.
Good.
Until next time, I'm Krista Longton, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.